Iran's president has blamed the West for creating crisis in the face of talks to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. EU's top diplomat admits that despite failure of the US maximum pressure campaign, Iranians have been deprived of the full benefits of the nuclear deal. The International Monetary Fund says despite Western sanctions against Moscow over the war in Ukraine, Russia's economy is doing better than expected. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's president has blamed the West for creating crisis in the face of talks to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ebrahim Raisi said the US, the UK, France and Germany caused the crisis by submitting an anti-Tehran resolution to the IAEA. He said Iran has adopted a rational and logical approach towards the JCPOA revival negotiations. He said the talks can bear fruit if the West pursues the same approach. The IAEA Board of Governors approved the resolution in June. The motion accused Iran of not cooperating with the agency over its past nuclear activities. Iran condemned the resolution and informed the IAEA that it will disconnect some of the agency's cameras installed under the JCPOA. On Monday, Iran said it will keep the cameras turned off until the deal is restored. Political commentator Abbas Aslani explains why Iran has decided to turn off the cameras installed by the IAEA.
Well, Iran tried to keep the cameras in place in order to show good faith. And it also clinched a deal with the IAEA in order to say that it will record the data by the camera. But once the JCPOA, meaning the 2015 nuclear deal, is restored, it will give the data to the IAEA. But on the other hand, the director general of the agency, they did not react, you know, constructively to Iranian measures. Iran's argument was that as much as Tehran continues to do measures and moves in good faith, but the IAEA responds in a different way. That's why Iran's Atomic Energy Organization decided to stop those cameras from working. But the solution to this problem is very easy. Once all the parties to the nuclear deal, as well as if the U.S. wants to re-enter the deal, if they return to their commitments under the JCPOA, all the things can be resolved very quickly and easily, and Iran can resume its commitments that were, mentioned in the terms of the deal. But the problem is that the other parties and side, including the IAEA, what they do is that they want Iran to fulfill its commitments just in a one-sided road, but they ignore that they themselves also have some other commitments and obligations to do.
In other news, the EU's foreign policy chief says the US maximum pressure campaign against Iran that brought the JCPOA to a standstill has been a failure. Josep Borrell, the EU coordinator for the JCPOA revival talks, made the remarks in an article published by the UK-based Daily Financial Times. Borrell admitted that despite the failure of the so-called maximum pressure campaign, Iranian people have been deprived the full benefits of the deal. Borrell said that he has offered a text that addresses the removal of sanctions and other steps needed to restore the JCPOA. Hours later, Iran's chief negotiator Ali Bagherikani tweeted that Iran has its own ideas to conclude the negotiations both in substance and in form, which will be shared. The JCPOA was clinched by Iran and the P5+1 to allow for the removal of anti-Iran sanctions in exchange for restrictions on Iran's nuclear work. The US withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reinstated the sanctions. Tehran says the revival of the deal hinges on Washington's political will to provide guarantees that Iran can reap full benefits economically entitled to under the accord. Iran has dismissed Israel's anti-Tehran accusations, saying the regime is struggling to distract attention from its atrocities against the Palestinians.
The Israeli regime's representative has once more abused this forum and made false accusations against my country, all of which are categorically rejected. These unfounded allegations are intended to distract attention from the continuous atrocities and violation of international law committed by the Israeli regime in the occupied Palestine and other countries in the region.
Iran's deputy UN ambassador Zahra Ershadi was addressing a UN Security Council session on the situation in Palestine. She said the regime's weapons of mass destruction pose a serious threat to security of the entire West Asia. Ershadi said Israel has even threatened regional countries with nuclear annihilation. She said the Security Council's inaction has emboldened Israel to continue its crimes against the Palestinians and keep up its aggressive behavior in the region. Ershadi urged the Security Council to force Israel to immediately stop its systematic violation of human rights and international humanitarian law. She said it is time for the Security Council to force Israel to adhere to international agreements banning weapons of mass destruction.
More abused.
Iran has once again foiled an Israeli act of sabotage. Earlier this week, the intelligence ministry released a statement saying it arrested members of a terrorist group affiliated with Israeli spy agency Mossad. The terror plot adds fuel to the existing tensions that Tehran says could backfire on Israel in terms of security.
Israel has a history of either attempting to or conducting acts of terrorism in Iran. But more often than not, Tehran successfully discovers and prevents such attacks. On Saturday, Iran's intelligence ministry issued a statement saying that members of a terrorist group affiliated with Mossad were identified and arrested by Iranian security forces before they could take any action to carry out acts of sabotage. The ministry added that terrorists who were in contact with Mossad agents through one of the neighboring countries had sneaked into the country while carrying highly explosive bombs. Later, reports emerged that the espionage planned to blow up a sensitive facility in the central Iranian province of Isfahan. This, however, isn't the first time Israel had planned on carrying out acts of terrorism in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's intelligence ministry forces had also captured individuals linked to Mossad in April. The spies were involved in disseminating classified information and documents. In July, Iran arrested another network of agents while they were carrying a large cache of weapons and ammunition with the intentions of provoking riots and terror inside the country.
Earlier in March, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps foiled yet another Israeli act of terror. The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps said it stopped an imminent Israeli plot to sabotage the Fordow uranium enrichment plant.
Israel has, however, conducted a few terrorist acts against Iran over the past years, namely the murder of top Iranian scientists and army generals and acts of sabotage on nuclear sites. Yet, interestingly enough, the regime continues such atrocities without being held accountable by the international community, and more specifically the U.S., who has supported Israel through its veto power in the United Nations Security Council.
The impunity with which Israel carries out such attacks or in this case, makes such plans, is fully enabled by the United States of America, which at this point, I believe, should be deemed responsible for the crimes and the destabilization that the apartheid state of Israel engages in. The primary way that the United States enables the crimes and the destabilization of Zionism and the colonialist apartheid state of Israel is through its veto in the United Nations. Since 1972, the United States has vetoed 53 resolutions attempting to hold Israel to account by way of international law.
Israel also has a track record of assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists. That's in addition to acts of sabotage on a section of Iran's nuclear facility in the city of Karaj. These are actions that threaten the entire region, yet the regime accuses Iran of destabilizing the region.
Israel has been involved in a string of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities in recent years and has killed many top nuclear scientists and military officials in cowardly strikes. More recently, on May 22nd, Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodai was assassinated by two motorcyclists who shot him 5 times before fleeing the scene. He was dismounting his car to enter his home in an eastern neighborhood of the Iranian capital when 3 bullets hit him in the head and 2 bullets in the hand. While Israel has yet to officially comment on the incident or take blame, all reports and facts indicated that it has so far been behind the terrorist activities in Iran. Regarding the Khodai case, American outlet The New York Times cited an intelligence official as saying that Israel has informed American officials that it was behind the assassination. Despite all this, the regime continues its petty attempts of trying to accuse Iran of destabilizing the region.
Israel attacks its neighbors on almost a daily basis, for example, bombing Syria, whereas Iran has not attacked a neighboring country in over 300 years, or almost 300 years. Furthermore, the very well-known international human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, as well as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, have deemed Israel to be an apartheid state, which inherently, as such, destabilizes the region. So there's nothing new here in terms of the Israeli and American narrative, their propaganda regarding Iran. What I do see as new and heartening is the fact that the effectiveness of this narrative is weakening very rapidly.
Israeli atrocities have also garnered fierce response from Iranian officials. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has warned that Iran will take a harsh revenge on those who assassinated a member of the force in Tehran.
The commander of the Iranian Army's ground force has warned that Tehran will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel makes any attempts against Tehran. Brigadier General Qumars Haydari also stated that Israeli occupied territories will be liberated in less than 25 years.
Russia's economy is apparently doing better than expected following the war in Ukraine. The International Monetary Fund says the Russian economy appears to be weathering the storm of Western sanctions. The IMF points to rising energy prices as a main reason why Russia's economic downturn is not as bad as expected. Another reason is that Russian officials have managed to stave off a banking panic or financial meltdown when the sanctions were first imposed. The Western sanctions were meant to sever Russia from global financial systems and choke off funds available to Moscow to finance the war. The IMF says Europe is bearing the brunt of the fallout from sanctions given its reliance on Russia for energy. The situation could worsen dramatically if Moscow cuts off gas exports to Europe. The European Union's energy minister has reached an agreement on cutting gas consumption in their countries by this winter as Russia slashes gas supply. In their meeting in Brussels, member states agreed on a voluntary reduction of 15% gas demand starting from next month. However, Hungary, which largely depends on Russian oil and gas, called the accord unenforceable, becoming the only bloc member to oppose the plan. The agreement comes after Russia's Gazprom announced that it will reduce gas supplies through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Germany to 20%. The energy giant cited technical issues for the decision, but the EU energy policy chief has accused Russia of blackmailing the 27-member bloc and using energy as a weapon. Moving to the UK, the race to replace Boris Johnson as leader of Britain's Conservative Party and Prime Minister heated up when the two candidates, former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, made their pitches on live television. In a sometimes ill-tempered debate, both candidates were quick to attack each other's record and credibility. Amina Taylor watched the political drama unfold and reports from the British capital, London. Let's take a listen.
And you dismissed us, and it has cost taxpayers 70...
After the warm-up bouts of debates featuring multiple leadership candidates, it was time for the final two to square off in a live televised debate. The head-to-head was the first opportunity viewers, including the estimated 170,000 members of the Conservative Party eligible to vote in the leadership race, could see Liz Truss, Foreign Secretary, face off against former Chancellor Rishi Sunak. Each wasted little time attacking each other's records and credentials and clashed heavily on their individual taxation plans to bring the country out of its worst cost of living crisis in generations.
We are an outlier. Everybody understands that COVID is a 1-in-100-year event, and trying to pay it back straight away, so quickly, that we actually damage our economy, that we end up causing a recession, that we end up in people being out of work, and that hard-working taxpayers who do the right thing have seen their taxes rise, despite the fact that we promised in our manifesto
I think that is wrong. You just mentioned three countries. Do you know what mortgage rates are in the US at the moment? Do you want to use them as an example? Their mortgage rates are almost 50% higher than mortgage rates in this country because they're borrowing so much.
I'm sorry, this is scaremongering. Canada actually has project fear.
The candidates vying for the country's top job have not shied away from going after each other's political juggler. Some of the exchanges have been brutal, with a former chancellor accused of talking down to his political rival, while Liz Truss has honed in on Rishi Sunak's immense wealth. Now, Tory grandees are fearful that whoever wins this vote, it's actually the Tory party with all of this mudslinging that will be the eventual loser. Former Mayor of London Ken Livingstone has been keenly observing the leadership race. Polls have Rishi Sunak trailing Liz Truss amongst rank-and-file Tory members, and with ballot papers being sent out in early August, both candidates want to build momentum. The results of the leadership ballot will be revealed on September the 5th, still years ahead of a general election that will see the nation have the final say. Amina Taylor, London.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the chair of the UK Labour Party, Annalise Dodds, said, while the Conservatives fight among themselves, British families are stuck waiting hours on end to begin their family holiday as the chaos in Dover Port continues. And once again, the government has failed to get a grip. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Michael Savage, John Ungo-Thomas and Miranda Bryant. The piece is titled Travel Chaos is the New Normal After Brexit. British tourists are warned. Holidaymakers have been warned long summer queues at the border risk becoming the new normal after Brexit, as a fierce diplomatic row erupted with France over the lengthy tailbacks affecting Dover. Both Tory leadership candidates rushed to blame a shortage of French border staff for delays that saw some travellers waiting for hours. Former British Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak said the French need to stop blaming Brexit and start getting the staff required to match demand. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said she was in touch with her French counterparts, blaming a lack of resources at the border. However, diplomats, French officials and border staff warned that the delays were a result of post-Brexit border arrangements struggling to cope in their first major test since Britain left the European Union. It comes after holidaymakers faced extensive queues for a second day at Dover on Saturday, 23rd of July, while there was also congestion on several major motorways as families across the country set out on their summer holidays. New rules require all passports to be checked, a pressure that a series of experts regarded as the biggest factor that could not easily be fixed. Clement Beaune, the French Transport Minister, said recently that he was cooperating with Transport Secretary Grant Shapps to ease the issues, but added, France is not responsible for Brexit. It follows frustration among Port of Dover executives that the government turned down a £33 million bid to help upgrade the port to cope with the additional pressures of Brexit. Instead, it was given just £33,000 in December of 2020, equivalent to 0.1% of the initial request. The Port of Dover warned at the time that the clock is ticking. Roger Gough, leader of Kent County Council, said, "We're still on a bit of a knife edge. We have a fragile system at Dover Port, and it does not take much for it to fall over. The pressures are intense and there is concern it could go on for some time." Lord Ricketts, Britain's former ambassador to France, said that the delays were an inevitable outcome of the bureaucracy created by Brexit. Lord Ricketts said the shortage of French border force officials is a short-term tactical problem. "The long-term serious issue is that this is the first time we've seen the full pressure on the border after Brexit. Even if it was a full complement of the French border force, there would still be massive delays, because Dover Port can't cope with the volume." He said the underlying reality is that no matter how many they have, given the size of the port, given the fact that the government failed to invest in expanding the facilities, it is going to be like this. This will be the new normal. He said that good relations and cooperation with the French was the best way of easing the issue, but added, "Of course the French will be watching this and will say, yet again, you've become a political football in the party leadership issue." Lucy Morrison, a professional officer at the Immigration Services Union, also said it was predictable that Brexit would cause more disruption because of the additional checks required. Morrison added, "This is the time it's chosen to bite." Pierre-Henri Dumont, a Les Républicains MP whose constituency includes Calais, told Sky News, "Because of Brexit, we need to have more checks on passports. We need to stamp every passport. We need to have checks on who is coming into the European Union," adding, "It is something we didn't have to do before Brexit. What we are experiencing is not because of the bad faith of the French authorities, but because of Brexit." He said there would be disruption for years if there was no major transformation of the Port of Dover. There are now warnings that delays could become even longer with the planned introduction of biometric checks under the European Union's new entry-exit system. Intense discussions have already been taking place between the Home Office and French authorities over their introduction, after warnings they could lead to queues of 17 miles. However, the Observer understands that the introduction of the new system is likely to be delayed again as officials attempt to ensure that their introduction causes as little disruption as possible. The new system may mean people will be required to leave their vehicles for the biometric checks. A Commons Transport Committee report on the road freight supply chain warned last month. The introduction of the European Union's new entry-exit system later in 2022 threatens to cause further confusion, disruption and delay at the UK's border, particularly at the port of Dover. It is crucial the government gets a grip of this issue. The chair of the Labour Party, Annalise Dodds, said, "While the Conservatives fight among themselves, families are stuck waiting hours on end to begin their family holiday as the chaos in Dover continues. And once again, the government has failed to get a grip." Leila Moran, the Liberal Democrat foreign affairs spokesperson, said, "We now have a zombie government completely incapable of sorting this mess out. The gridlock at Dover is not only having a huge impact on families, but also on businesses and workers already facing soaring prices. Every delay hurts our economy and impacts on our vital tourism industry. Conservative ministers will be rightly blamed." A government spokesperson claimed a shortage of French border control staff at border in Dover, who control entry to France, and exceptionally high numbers of people travelling this weekend have led to roads in Kent becoming extremely busy. "We're working closely with French authorities, the Port of Dover, Kent Resilience Forum and police to ease disruption and provide underground support." The government spokesman added, "We strongly recommend passengers check the latest advice from their operators before travelling and, as with any long journey, ensure they have enough water and food provisions with them."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to your own program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in the studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Sheikh Miqdad, who is a researcher in the House of Ilmi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, and salam to all the listeners, inshallah, out there.
Brother Miqdad, in our previous sessions, we talked about few steps that could help boys going through puberty. That was the things that are in our control. We can limit them. We can make dress code at home decent. We can take care of the relationship between father and mother, like, they need to take care of the conversations and anything that causes oversensitivity or curiosity, and they need to create a safe environment. Are there any more things that parents could do to help boys going through puberty?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we talked about the sexual exposure that needs to be controlled. And we talked about what we can do at home.
Yes.
Obviously, there's more we can do, but I think, inshallah, the listeners got the point of how we can really try our best to control this, but do it together with the child. That's very important. Other things that we can do to kind of limit this sexual exposure is make sure that they have good friends.
Okay.
This something we'll repeat many times. The role of friends in a teenager is extremely important.
Okay.
Who your child and who your kind of teenage boys hang around with will have a very strong impact in not just the exposure to sexual content, but also generally to the emotional maturity and the intellectual maturity will be impacted by what kind of people they hang around with. So it's very important that you choose or you help them choose good friends.
Okay.
And generally, it's important that parents get involved in their child's school life as well. So being in touch with the teacher, whatever school they're going, whether Muslim school or non-Muslim school, being in touch with the school teacher, what's happening in school on a general basis is very important.
Okay.
Sometimes you find parents are very much like they send their own life.
They have admitted a child in a school and they really don't care.
Exactly. Yeah. So a child goes to school from 8 to 2 or 8 to 3, and that's it. They don't really care what's happening.
Yes.
No. Be a bit more involved. Know what's happening at school. What kind of things school is exposing them to?
Yes.
Because you find that some schools are very kind of open to exposure.
Yes.
Especially in Europe right now, especially in Canada right now, there's a whole movement of RE, religious education, as well as RSE, sexual education as well. This is kind of the explicitly getting children to know about things much earlier than necessary. So it's good that you are aware of this, that you speak to your school, your teacher, but also local community members as well. So a lot of the Muslim communities have got together to kind of discuss these issues, because it's a big issue. Schooling in Europe is a very big issue. In Canada, same thing. So,
is there anything you could tell to parents over here, like who are more concerned about putting their children in a schools that are brands? For example, I remember something from my past, like there were some parents who were really concerned about admitting their children to the schools which were branded schools, okay? But the same schools in the Muslim society used to teach singing and dancing and guitars and pianos at a very early age, which is also haram in Islam, but parents hardly cared about that. But they were more concerned about that we should feel proud in the society because our child is studying in a school that's among the top 10 list.
Yeah. So basically, it's the kind of debate between academic performance and religious maturity, basically. Academic performance is extremely important. I mean, hats off to all the parents out there. I would strongly encourage, not just for myself, but Islamically, we're strongly encouraged to make sure that your academic performance is excellent.
Excellent.
So those Muslim schools, for example, that are putting too much emphasis on religion and kind of ignoring the academic performance, that's very bad, right?
Okay.
So definitely be very strongly, put priority as academic for sure. I don't deny that at all. On the contrary, I think it's a very important factor. Whenever you're choosing school for your child, always have academic performance and the reputation of the school, the level of academic kind of level that they can achieve is very important, definitely. And you want the best for your child. That's what school is all about in the end.
Okay. I think this needs some explanation. I'll talk to you on that after a short break. To listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIP English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about the things how boys can deal with the age of puberty. Yes, brother, you were talking about the schools.
So you raise a very important question. Could you deal with it? Inshallah, we'll move on. So when it comes to school, academic performance is very important. It should be a number, it should be a very important priority in terms of when we're looking for schools. So as you mentioned, brand schools, reputable schools, or schools that are performing well in academic field,
yeah.
They need to be set as a priority for our children. We want our children to be very strong in the academic. However, and a big however, you can make it in bold, that this is not at the expense of religious principles.
Yes.
Right? This is very important. So we always try to bring them together, have the academic performance as well as the religious. So if you have schools that are Islamic schools and that are doing really well academically, that's ideal. Always go for that.
Okay. Right?
If you have schools that are academically very strong but are going to destroy your religious principles, mm-hmm. then definitely don't go for that.
Okay.
Right? Simply put, would you like your child to turn into a very amazing astronaut but then end up in hell?
Okay, right?
If
yes.
you want to put it black and white, you want your child, yes, you want the best for your child in this world, definitely. You want them to become amazing doctors and lawyers and engineers and astronauts, right?
Okay.
But at the same time, you want them to kind of do well in the hereafter. You want
yes.
them to also become a true human being,
yes.
right? Being a good doctor, being a good businessman, but having no faith has no value.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's what we believe in. That's what the reality is. This world is a bridge to the next world. Yes, make sure that we have academic performance and we have great careers in our Muslim community, but not at the expense of losing our faith. So
yes.
if you have a school that's doing extremely well, but they're going to destroy for sure our religious principles, then definitely it's a school that you don't want to put your child in. According to some of the maraji, it's also haram as well.
Okay.
The discussion is often where you kind of have a bit of both, where do you have to draw the line? And this is probably most scenarios. I mean, the second scenario I mentioned is kind of not so common. Most scenarios is where, like, okay, I can do a bit of both, where I can kind of manage between a bit more strength in academic and maybe lack a bit of religious guidance and religious exposure. I'm not saying we should always opt for Islamic schools. I can't even understand that some of the Islamic schools out there, if not a lot of the Islamic schools out there, very often fail in their performance at the academic level.
Okay.
And so I won't encourage them to always choose that. Sometimes
yes.
you do.
Okay.
And sometimes they will encourage you to do, depending on what kind of school it is. But definitely you really want our Islamic schools to become better in the academic field as well.
Yes.
So ideally, you would, as a community, push for making our own schools
mm-hmm.
and push for those kind of schools that have both, that have a strong kind of academic performance as well as a good religious background.
Yeah.
It doesn't, when I say religious background, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to teach the most amazing aqaid and those kind of things. No, I'm not saying, we're not trying to create a house over there, right?
All
it's
right.
still a school.
Mm-hmm.
But simple things like exposure to things, what kind of discussions to have at what age. These kind of simple things basically play a very big
so
role.
So parents have to be careful about choosing school. They have to choose a school which, even if it's doing academically well, but not at the cost of the faith of their children.
Yeah.
Brother, I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "He who recites the Quran before puberty has indeed been given wisdom in his childhood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about things that could help boys to go through the age of puberty. Yes, brother, what are the other things that could help boys to go through puberty?
So we talked about sexual exposure at home,
yeah.
How to create a safe environment. We talked about that sexual exposure outside of home is going to happen.
Yes.
Right? Especially in the society that we live in today, it's extremely difficult to kind of be not exposed to it. But we said that there are certain things that we can do to limit it, at least to a certain extent. One of them we said was friends. Make sure you choose good friends. And you're careful about what kind of people your child is interacted with.
Yes.
Secondly, we talked about being involved in school life as well. Yes. Knowing, so as you mentioned, choosing the right school.
Yeah.
And also when you've chosen the right school, also then being involved in their school life, knowing what the school is exposing them to, what are they learning, what the child is doing before school, during school, after school, kind of being part of the school life. It's very, it's part of family life is being
not
involved in each
other's. Keeping your kid, like, not just keeping your child out from like 8 to 3 or 9 to 5 and then not knowing anything what he's being exposed to.
Exactly. And then thirdly is also a child's leisure time. So teenagers, and all of us actually, require leisure time, time where we kind of do our own things, call it pleasure, entertainment, leisure.
Okay.
These kind of thing needs to be controlled a lot. Controlled in the sense that guided, I would say, rather than using the word control, actually it was guided. Don't let your child do whatever they want in the leisure time.
Okay. Right?
They want to go to the cinema, for example, they can go to the cinema. Don't restrict cinema time. But guide them towards choosing the right film or the right movie, for example.
Okay. Right?
If they're going out for a meal, for example, or for a coffee, or they go to the mall, for example, don't restrict that because teenagers need to have that. But kind of guide them to choose a good place to go or how to deal about the different things.
Or choose a person, what person you are going
with. So choosing their friends, choosing the friends carefully, yes. All of that, basically, to kind of really help them limit the kind of exposure that they're going to have.
Okay.
This is very important. So be also kind of involved in the leisure time. It's not like you give them pocket money and say, do whatever you want with it.
Okay.
Right? You're kind of helping them, guiding them.
You can kind of give pocket money and then ask them what you did with it so that every time you're giving, you can know what they are doing.
Even better than asking them what they did, I would say is guide them towards what to do with it. See,
okay.
Children, teenagers don't like policing. They don't like mom and dads that are acting
asking
like police.
Asking questions,
exactly.
Yes.
They want to be independent. They want to do what they like to do.
Mm-hmm.
So your role is not to restrict. Your role is not to police, but rather to guide and to help them make the right decisions.
Well, thank you, brothers, so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. We talked about the things parents could do to help their boys go through puberty. Thank you so much for listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to this program again, you can just go back to our website, that's www.parstoday.com, and search us under the tab of Call of Islam. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., in a speech on Monday, 20th of June, former Vice President Mike Pence sounded like a future presidential candidate, but not like someone interested in discussing the specifics of 6th of January 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman and Reed Epstein. The piece is titled, Pence Navigates a Possible White House Run and a Fraught Political Moment. Former Vice President Mike Pence has emerged from the January 6 hearings in a peculiar position. To some Democrats in Congress, he has become something of a hero for resisting Donald J. Trump's pressure campaign to overturn the 2020 election at a time when American democracy seemed to teeter on the brink. To Donald Trump, however, and his political base, Mike Pence is a weakling who gave away the presidency. And to a swathe of anti-Trump voters in both political parties, he is merely someone who finally did the right thing by standing up to his former boss, years too late after willingly defending or ignoring some of Donald Trump's earlier excesses. The whipsaw of images creates an uncertain foundation for a potential presidential campaign, for which Mike Pence has been laying the groundwork. Yet the former vice president is continuing with his travels around the country in advance of the 2024 primaries, as he navigates his fraught positioning. Much as he did after the 2020 presidential election, when he tried to keep his tensions with Donald Trump from becoming public, only to have him push them into the light, Mr. Pence continues to walk a tightrope, trying to make the best of a situation he didn't seek without becoming openly adversarial to the president with whom he served and who remains the leader of the Republican Party. Mr. Pence himself has said little about 6th of January 2021, though his aides have testified about his resolve as Donald Trump and his allies tried to press him to subvert President Joe Biden's victory. On Monday, in an economic speech at the University Club of Chicago, Mike Pence sounded very much like a presidential candidate, but not much like someone interested in discussing the specifics of what he lived through on 6th of January 2021. We've all been through a lot over the last several years, Mike Pence told the audience. A global pandemic, social unrest, a divisive election, a tragic day in our nation's capital, and an administration seemingly every day driving our economy into the abyss of a socialist welfare state. Insights into Mr. Pence's mindset at the time have come largely from the testimony of his former chief of staff, Mark Short, and his former counsel, Greg Jacob. Mike Pence, as he made clear in his Chicago speech, has kept his sights trained on the Biden administration and on electing Republicans, including Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia and others, who were sharply at odds with Donald J. Trump in the midterm elections. If Mr. Pence has sharper things to say, he may not do so until the fall, when he has a book coming out. The situation Mike Pence faces is a political briar patch, said David Kochel, a Republican strategist who worked on Jeb Bush's presidential campaign in 2016. The more he's praised by Democrats and the media for doing the right thing on 6th of January 2021, the more some in Trump's base grows skeptical of his loyalty to the Trump team. He added, there is no upside for him to lean into any of this. In Peoria, Illinois, Mike Pence called on Republicans to focus on the future and not the 2020 presidential election, an indirect reference to Donald Trump's incessant focus on his election loss that continues to this day. In the days between now and Election Day, let's cast a positive vision for the future for the American people, Mike Pence told a crowd of Republican activists at a Lincoln Day dinner. Yes, let's be the loyal opposition. Let's hold the other side accountable every single day. In the days between now and Election Day, we need you to say yes. Yes to the future. Yes to the future of freedom and our cherished values. And the Republican Party must be the party of the future. Three times Mike Pence lauded accomplishments of the Trump-Pence administration. And he related a story from his high school reunion about a former classmate who encouraged him by telling him, "We need you guys back." During the speech, Kathy Sparrow, the chairwoman of the Republican Party of Hancock County, Illinois, shouted, "Pence for president." Mike Pence ignored the shout. Trump had his turn, Kathy Sparrow said after Mike Pence's remarks. It's now time for Pence to step up and run for president. The attention on Mike Pence provides both potential benefit and peril as he considers running for president. Payments from Democrats certainly do not help him, but his actions before, during and after January 6 give him an opportunity to differentiate himself in what could be a crowded primary field, one that may include Donald J. Trump. Mike Pence, whose support for Mr. Trump helped allay concerns about him from the evangelical voters in 2016, has the advantage of starting as a known entity to the Republican base. Mike Pence has tried to stake out a lane for himself by representing the aspects of the Trump White House that appeal to conservatives, but without the coarse and sometimes abusive behavior from Mr. Trump that they grew weary of. But this approach has been complicated by the fact that the loudest praise for Mike Pence has come from Democrats who voted to impeach Donald Trump. In a time of absolutely scandalous betrayal of people's oaths of office and crimes being committed all over the place, somebody who does their job and sticks to the law will stand out as a hero on that day. Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland and a member of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6 attacks, said on NBC News' Meet the Press program on Sunday. Jamie Raskin added, "And on that day, Mike Pence was a hero." Many other Democrats, however, have resisted the idea that Mr. Pence, who is known as cautious and loyal and who did not break with Donald Trump until the very end, should be praised, particularly as he considers campaigning to be the next president. Pence is currently on his own political rehab tour, hoping he can wash the stink of being Trump's vice president off, the Arizona Democratic Party said in a blast email when Mike Pence made a trip to the southern border in that state recently. But we know just because Mike Pence didn't give in on 6th of January 2021 doesn't change the fact that he missed multiple opportunities to do the right thing for four whole years. Other Democrats, including the members of the Democratic National Committee, have highlighted that Mike Pence adhered closely to Donald Trump without wavering during some of the biggest controversies of Trump's presidency, including his first impeachment, and that Mr. Pence did not speak publicly about his views until moments before the election certification began on 6th of January 2021. Nonetheless, even some of the harshest critics of the Trump era have said that the actions of 6th of January should not be treated lightly. It's true that for months before the election and weeks after, Mike Pence played along with Donald Trump's baseless election conspiracies, said David Axelrod, a former top advisor to former President Barack Obama. Axelrod added, he certainly didn't dissent, but at the end of the day, he'll be remembered for one critical moment when he resisted enormous pressure and literally put his life on the line for our democracy. And for that, he deserves all the accolades that he's received. The complaints from Democrats have focused not just on Mike Pence's tolerance for Donald Trump's norm-shattering behavior, but also for the Trump administration's policies. Mr. Pence's aides say he believed the administration was enacting policies he generally agreed with, including putting forward conservative nominees for 3 Supreme Court seats. His long loyalty to Donald Trump could resonate with some Republicans, but with the former president demanding total fealty, it is a difficult line to walk. The irony is that Mike Pence was arguably the prime enabler of Donald Trump, said Rob Stutzman, a Republican strategist based in California. Stutzman added, he was the mainstream traditional conservative Republican who would go to donors and not just defend Donald Trump and his policies, but with a straight face, insist that Donald J. Trump was a good man. Mr. Short, Mike Pence's former chief of staff, has been critical of aspects of the House committee's work at a time when Donald Trump has encouraged his supporters to view the panel as illegitimate. That has allowed Mike Pence to keep some distance from the work of the committee, which he has not appeared before himself. Officials are expected to try again to ask Mike Pence to testify, a move he will most likely resist. On Sunday, Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat of California and a member of the House committee, left open the idea that requesting his presence may still happen. Certainly a possibility, Adam Schiff said. We're not excluding anyone or anything at this point.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.